From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. President Trump's budget blueprint revealed today includes large increases for defense spending while slashing funding for the State Department and international aid programs. How would these new priorities reshape America's role in the world? We'll talk with Stanford political scientist Larry Diamond, who has been sounding the alarm about the decline of democracy around the globe.
We have seen an erosion of civil liberties and political rights, resurgence of authoritarian norms and practices.
It's all coming up next, after the news. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to the Forum program. President Donald Trump released a budget proposal today that includes a $54 billion increase in defense spending and major cuts to the State Department, international aid, and climate change programs. The plan favors the hard power of the military might over the soft power of foreign aid and diplomacy. If approved by Congress, how will the cuts affect America's efforts to prevent conflict and promote democracy abroad? We're joined in this hour by Stanford political scientist Larry Diamond. He's been sounding the alarm about the rise of what he calls creeping authoritarianism around the world, and he's warned about what he calls Donald Trump's modern-day McCarthyism, which he says could pose a threat to democracy right here at home. Larry Diamond is a senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and at the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies, and welcome once again to the Forum program, Larry Diamond.
Nice to be with you, Michael.
Let's begin with the president's budget, and I just want listeners to know what we're talking about here. This will, of course, go through a lot of congressional approval process and chopping blocks in all kinds of ways, but there is $54 billion earmarked in this for defense, and it talks about a lot of more money for deporting and the undocumented and things that we expect from essentially what was heralded during President Trump's campaign for the presidency. The United States has been the main exporter of democracy for so long now, and a lot of people are saying, great, we're cutting foreign aid, we have more for defense, we're going to be stronger. How does this hurt, essentially, our proselytizing or our trying to have an impact on global democracy?
Well, Michael, you make a few good points. Let me begin by highlighting the essential ones. Number one, democracy has been slipping in the world and freedom along with it for about a decade now. It's becoming kind of critical. There are a number of countries, and not only developing and post-communist countries, that are in trouble or at a tipping point. We, the community of democracies, not just the United States, but the European Union, Japan, other advanced industrial democracies, even Taiwan has a foundation that's been assisting Democrats, particularly in Asia, we can make a difference. We have in the past by our assistance to democratic groups in these countries, by our support for independent media, and by what we say and do diplomatically. But if we withdraw, the field will be open to autocrats to do whatever they want. And secondly, I think you implied, and certainly even the Secretary of Defense, James Mattis, has stressed, as has John McCain and others, that we can't do what we need to do to fight international terrorism and extremism and anti-Americanism and threats to our hard national security without projecting soft power, without fighting on a moral level, on an ideational level, on an informational level, Islamic terrorism. And you can't beat something with nothing. You've got to have an alternative. And the alternative is good, decent, accountable governance. This is why Tunisia, Michael, is so important now, because it's the only Arab country that is actually making some progress in institutionalizing democracy. Finally, the third point, which many people have made recently, is that if you completely eliminated the Department of State and foreign aid altogether, you still wouldn't be able to pay for probably even half of the defense increase that President Trump wants. So, you know, you can't really achieve what he's trying to achieve very effectively on the backs of foreign aid and diplomatic representation around the world, and the cost to the goals President Trump is trying to promote in terms of extending and improving our national security will not be served by that.
Well, let's talk about something else that you have pointed out and that one hears from a number of analysts. I want to get into the global picture with you, which you've defined in terms of democracy and has declined with a good deal of concern. But you've also expressed concern about nativism and anti-pluralism, conspiracy theories, all allied to some extent with the Trump administration, which pretty much you see, I believe, as a kind of modern-day McCarthyism, and that a man who said during the campaign he alone can really do all these things and find all these solutions?
Well, let me be precise about this. I certainly do not think the entire administration is McCarthyite. There are a number of people in the administration now and others who may go in who I have enormous respect for. I've mentioned one, my former colleague at the Hoover Institution, Secretary of Defense James Mattis. Another who we also know here at Hoover and came to admire a lot is the new National Security Advisor, H.R. McMaster. I personally think, Michael, that the nominee for Deputy Attorney General looks like a very able man, and the Democrats should just approve him. The Democrats are not blameless here in their contribution to the stalemate that we're confronting now, which is beyond healthy. But President Trump has said things and done things that I think represent an undemocratic spirit. Unsubstantiated charges is the essence of McCarthyism. And there's a continuing stream of them right up through the latest charge that President Obama wiretapped his offices in Trump Tower with absolutely no evidence presented, zero. I mean, that is the pure definition of McCarthyism.
Of course, now he's moving back on that to some extent,
yeah,
saying,
course.
You know, quotation
so
marks.
So did Joe McCarthy at times, too.
Well, do you think we are slipping toward autocracy despite maybe many good people having been named by the Trump administration because of the man who actually you made the comparison to and others have the character in Sinclair Lewis's It Can't Happen Here, which sort of suggests mm-hmm. that it can happen here?
Well, and I've said very recently that the worst form of fatal conceit for Democrats is to assume that because democracy has been stable for however long, that it must therefore be stable and secure indefinitely. As we see from recent public opinion polling, which has some disturbing evidence in it that we can talk about in terms of American and European attitudes toward democracy, democracy as a system of government is a fragile thing, and it rests ultimately on a belief in its legitimacy, and that has to be understood by every generation and renewed in every generation. More specifically to President Trump, I think that, you know, Democrats, progressives, people who didn't vote for him, people who may be getting uneasy about him need to be careful and they need to be responsible. I really kind of cringe when I hear the word fascism used. You know, we're not on the edge of Nazi Germany or Mussolini's Italy. And if we use overstated, overheated, grossly exaggerated rhetoric, I think we lose credibility with a lot of people that we want to win over to a position of serious scrutiny and vigilance. So, yes, I'm worried about his intentions because of what he said in the campaign. I am worried about his principal strategic advisor, Steve Bannon, because of the many things he has said and what he's represented. But I think we need to evaluate each action, policy, and statement.
Well, when you talk about the fragility of democracies, in fact, you've written about this. You had an op-ed in the Sunday Chronicle, and you were quoting Seymour Martin Lipset about performance legitimacy versus intrinsic legitimacy. Intrinsic legitimacy makes for a much more stable or at least enduring democracy than the idea of performance, but you bring these figures into the mix. 70% of those committed to democracy, with no more than 15% supporting an authoritarian figure. Those numbers are shifting around the world. And in order to have a stable democracy, you need at least 70% from your vantage point that need to be committed. That's the intrinsic democracy and legitimacy.
Right. You want to get to a situation where people believe, even if they're unhappy with who leads the government at a particular period of time, that the democratic institutions, the democratic constitutional system is still the best system for the country. Excuse me. And if they lose, they simply wait for another opportunity. And, you know, my study over 35 years looking at this phenomenon and this data suggests that democracies become insecure and certainly at risk of erosion, if not failure, if you don't have a strong consensus on that. And that means you need well over two-thirds who really have that kind of intrinsic legitimacy. And you don't want too large a group, I think not more than 10 or 15%, who are actively saying, let's have an authoritarian leader. And if you look at what's happened in terms of American public opinion, let me give you two statistics. In 1995, when a survey is done and people were asked, would you favor army rule, that is a military coup in the United States so that the military would rule, 6% said yes. When that question was asked again in 2014, 16% said yes. And when people were asked whether they'd like to have a strong leader who doesn't have to bother with elections and Congress and can just kind of make decisions, you've got about a quarter of the American public now saying, yeah, that's a good idea. And actually, you know, if you listen to our Constitution and our founders and our history and world history, no, it's a really bad idea.
Well, you say it's up to the people to keep democracy intact. I mean, that's your essential argument and one with which most people in this republic would probably agree. But you have this growing number of people who feel that maybe a strong man like we presently have, at least the appearance he gives of being that, is preferable somehow to what is considered or deemed to be weakness. And you also point out that political polarization helps the movement toward autocracy.
Yes, it does, because it drives people to the extremes. And then you're going to have a lot of people available to be mobilized by a populist leader, either of the extreme left like Hugo Chavez or of the extreme right like Putin or Erdogan in Turkey now. And also when you have political polarization, Michael, what happens is things don't get done. Policy can't be made. And people's needs are not being addressed. And when policy is not being made to address the fundamental problems in the country, and that happens over an extended period of time, it does erode popular faith in democracy. And that has been happening, not catastrophically yet, but disturbingly in Europe and the United States.
And also in the Philippines with Duterte.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I mean, really all over the globe. Unfortunately, you mentioned Thailand before, but we saw a strong man there as well. And I guess what I really want to get to here with you is how to make the world safe for democracy, since there are those, and you, in fact, point your finger very accusingly at Putin as making the world safe for autocracy. Spell out for listeners, if you could, why you came to that conclusion.
Well, look what he's been doing. Vladimir Putin has launched a massive multi-billion dollar effort, dwarfing now what we are doing in real terms to disinform people about what's happening in the world, in democratic nations around the world, to spread, you know, Soviet-style disinformation, what we now call fake news and propaganda, to bribe and pull people away from their democratic attachments.
Forgive me, Larry. I'm not sure that President Trump would call it fake news when it comes to Vladimir Putin, but please proceed.
Well, you know, he has his constitutional right to call it whatever he wants. But on a show like yours, I think we can at least be fact-based here. And that is, in fact, what's been happening. And they have a very sophisticated machine for it. You've seen the FBI indictments about the scope recently of the penetration of the Yahoo accounts and the linkage of criminal elements, hacking elements in Russia to Russian intelligence and the Russian state apparatus. These things are incredibly intertwined. Putin has poured money into the projection of Russian soft power, often with this cynical line of discrediting democracy, promoting false information about it to damage not just candidates he didn't like in the United States, but he's been doing this in France and Germany and frankly all over Europe. So you've got this elaborate funding now of RT, the Russian international television effort, Sputnik, and many other efforts to sow disinformation, confusion, doubt, and cynicism about democracy. And we need to fight back. This is a plane of battle, Michael, that really will be as important as the military plane in determining the future of democracy in the world.
Well, there is what you call a campaign to sabotage that has gone out from Putin's Russia, and you describe it as opportunistic and sophisticated. But what it seems to be all about in many ways is make Russia great again, and what certainly has been heralded by Donald Trump is make America great again. How much of this movement toward autocracy, this creeping autocracy, as you see it, is tied to not only nativism, but really a strong and profound nationalism and almost a rigid nationalism?
Well, they are powerfully intertwined. Populist right-wing authoritarianism, you know, is almost at its core a nativist exclusivist, hyper-nationalist, extreme chauvinist projection of identity. There's not a lot else they have to mobilize to rally people around a cause but that, the defense of pseudo-national and, in this case, pseudo-Christian values. I can't think of anything that's a more profound betrayal of real Christian values than this kind of chauvinism, nativism, racism, and so on. But that's what they're mobilizing. Michael, let me say as well, and this is one of the reasons that gives me hope, these authoritarian regimes are not exactly raving success stories. We can talk about China later if you want, but as my colleague here at Hoover and Stanford and our former ambassador to Russia, Michael McFaul, keeps saying, you know, take a look at the Russian economy try to determine what basis there is for success, for real national achievement. Other than its reliance on oil and gas and then the, expansion of military power and the constant generation and provocation of regional and international threats to rally people behind it. This is not a long-term formula for success. And Putin really needs to have these regional and international conflicts in order to keep disguising the profound basis of his failure domestically, as sooner or later it's going to catch up with him.
Since you mentioned China, how do you see China in this whole picture? Because it's become an economic stronghold, and if anything, it's probably become even more autocratic.
Yes, I think there's no question that under Xi Jinping in the last 4 years or so, China has become a deeper, more aggressive in terms of its management of civil society and public opinion, a deeper and more assertive authoritarian regime, more controlling, less pluralistic. On the other hand, it's dealing with pretty serious governance and economic problems as well. The economic growth rate has slowed dramatically. Many observers believe it isn't quite near the 6.5% to 7% growth that's been reported, that they're playing with the statistics and generating their own kind of fake news in terms of reporting on their economy. There's a lot of unrest, and there's a lot of people voting with their feet. A lot of people with money are simply leaving. They're finding ways to get their money out of the country. They're sending their children abroad to study, and often they don't come back. They're buying homes elsewhere in the world, including in pretty considerable numbers here in the Bay Area. And frankly, they're hedging their bets because they don't have confidence in the future of their own political system.
If you've just joined us, we're talking with Larry Diamond, who is senior fellow at Hoover Institution and the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. Let me bring this back home for a moment, if I may, Larry. I mean, you talk about autocracy tied to the denial of legitimacy and branding opponents as being disloyal or semi-loyal and so forth. We have a president now who has pretty much indicted the judiciary, the intelligence operations, his predecessor, and so forth. So are we seeing a pattern there, as you see it, to autocracy?
Again, I want to reserve the warning bell for when the president has really crossed the line from style and rhetoric into actions. You know, Nixon was ordering the IRS to, you know, audit people, was trying to misuse the power of the executive branch to, you know, spy on his enemies list. Let's be clear about what the descent into real authoritarianism is. It involves serious abuse of presidential power and an attempt to eclipse freedom and demobilize political opposition. Again, I don't think that is yet what President Trump has done, but I am worried because of many of the things he and some of his strategists and supporters, some of them, have said during the campaign and in prior years. So I think the important thing now is vigilance. Very close scrutiny and monitoring, and having good and responsible people in positions of authority. And, you know, because much of what I've said about President Trump in the articles you've cited and in conversation here with you has been critical, I think it's important to make a point that some of your Democratic listeners, in terms of their party orientation, may not want to hear. Again, I think his nominee to be Deputy Attorney General is a good, serious, professional man. I have trouble believing we're going to get somebody better. I think Democrats would be crazy not to confirm him.
Larry, I'm going to have to jump in here because we're coming up on a break, and I want to give listeners an opportunity to join in here. In fact, let me give the phone number. You can join us now. We invite you to do that. Our toll-free number available to you is 866-733-6786. Again, join us at 866-733-6786. You can also email questions or comments, forum@kqed.org, or join us by going to our website, kqed.org/forum, and clicking on the segment, or tweet us. Our Twitter handle is @KQEDForum. We'll continue with Larry Diamond. We'll hear from you when we return. You're listening to Forum on KQED Public Radio. I'm Michael Krasny. This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Our guest this hour is Larry Diamond, senior fellow at the Hoover Institution and the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford, who has done a great deal of research and scholarship on democracy and what keeps it vital and what needs to be done to keep it enduring. So we are really focusing on the future of democracy, which I think it's easy to say and unfortunate. It's been under siege in many places, and Larry Diamond's been pointing out the need for vigilance and the need for good, responsible people. But I'd also point out a statistic of his, which is that there was between the mid-70s and the early 2000s an unprecedented United States-led global expansion of democracy. Actually, democratic countries doubled during that period, and now some are concerned about not only the falling away from democracy with one-man rules and with strongmen and the like, but we've been talking also not only about Russia and other countries, but the United States as well. And Larry, I want to give you an opportunity to just finish your thoughts because I had to go to a break there.
It's fine. The only other thing I would add, I was talking about confirming the nominee for Deputy Attorney General. I think the Democrats should also confirm Neil Gorsuch on the Supreme Court. They're not going to get a better nominee out of Trump. He looks independent-minded. He doesn't change the balance on the court. There's been, I think, some interesting speculation that on some issues he might even be a little more flexible than Antonin Scalia was. And he's a very impressive guy who I think will defend the Constitution and the rule of law.
I even criticized President Trump about his remarks about a judge in the ruling on the travel ban. And
I do not think that was political theater.
Well, let's go to the travel ban with you. Can I get your thoughts on that?
Well, I think I'm not a constitutional lawyer, so I can't tell you whether this iteration of the ban will be judged, because ultimately I think it's bound to go to the Supreme Court, whether it will be judged constitutional or not by this court. I can say I think it's unwise. I think that it plays into the hands of al-Qaeda and ISIS by feeding the narrative that they would like to spread around the world that the United States has been or is now anti-Islam. And so if you understand that the most fundamental element of the battle we face is on the plane of values, ideas, the way people think, and that that an essential part of countering violent Islamic extremism is to work on what they think and believe and to win them back to a more pluralistic and tolerant view of the world, I think this pushes likely many people in the wrong direction.
I'm going to go right to your calls. But first, let me get a response from you, Larry Diamond, to a question, I suppose you could say, or a statement posed by one of our listeners, Ben, who says, how much of this creeping autocracy has to do with the expansion of corporate powers and or kleptocracies around the world? It seems that democratic governance slows the giant capitalist machine, and currently there are corporations or cartels that have more power than many governments. I think that's arguable. And you were talking about Putin before. That's kind of a kleptocracy and a oligarchy. How much of this, in terms of just bottom line autocracy, has to do with bottom line corporate power and money?
Well, I think we need to separate two things. One is the phenomenon of kleptocracy, which is a phenomenon of a country's rulers stealing the economy, in essence. We're talking about political corruption on a staggering predatory scale and corporate power. So briefly on each, you find a strong association between persistent decadent authoritarianism and literally kleptocracy. In the post-Soviet world, not only Putin, who is widely believed to be probably one of the richest men in the world, and who Karen DeWisha, in her book on Putin, has completely unpacked in terms of his staggering, methodical, construction of this multi-billion-dollar empire, probably over 30 to 40 billion. But you see it with many other rulers in Kazakhstan, in Azerbaijan, in many Arab states, in many African states. You now have, a ruler in Malaysia, a soft authoritarian ruler. We're not talking about a dictator. We're talking about someone who's, at the helm of a multi-party system, but an autocratic system, Prime Minister Najib, who is reported to have embezzled over $1 billion that mysteriously wound up in his bank account. So if you can fight kleptocracy at this level, it's a very effective way of fighting authoritarianism, and we need stronger and more transparent rules for money laundering and the inspection of international banking records in order to do that. With respect to corporate power, I just think it depends on the corporation and it depends on the national context. Corporations also generate a lot of jobs, Michael. And without them, we don't have much of an economy. So you don't want to dismiss them all as greedy, blood-sucking, allies of kleptocrats. I think there's a lot of variation there. And what we need to do is create the enabling conditions for capital formation and the creation of new jobs, both in small new companies and in larger ones, while ensuring that they play by fair rules of economic competition and pay their taxes and so on.
Well, as long as we're talking about money and corporate power and the like, Wall Street Journal's reporting today, I just wanted to make this clear, that Michael Flynn was paid $33,000 by Russian TV and was paid thousands of dollars from Russian companies shortly before he became a formal Trump advisor. And those are business interests that hadn't previously been known or reported. And I have a little bit of pushback here, Larry Diamond, from a listener named Noob, who says, Trump and his administration are doing no less damage to our country and our values than Putin. I'd argue he's doing more. One decent cabinet member nominee does not a good cabinet make. Stop asking us to dumb down our concerns.
Well, I think we need to separate two things. Number one, the policies that Trump is proposing, which many people on the left and even the center may be distressed by. I personally am deeply concerned by some of the policy initiatives he's proposing on a number of fronts, including health care, and we've talked about the budget. But those are in the realm of, you know, normal political competition. I don't think they represent a threat to democracy itself. On the other hand, when he attacks the judiciary, the press, civil society, and so on, if he should misuse executive power, that's of a different order. That's crossed over from being a normal difference on an ideological or policy plane between Democrats and Republicans, liberals and conservatives, to being a fundamental threat to our democratic values and institutions. And I think we need to bear the distinction in mind.
And we'll bring our callers in. Jorge, your first caller up. Good morning.
Good morning. Yes, so I would like the guest to comment on the role of public education in maintaining a healthy democracy, and specifically if access to education is somehow related to people's ability to resist misinformation and propaganda.
Yeah, good question. Thank you for it, Jorge. Larry Diamond.
Oh, that's a fabulous question. Thank you so much, Jorge. I think that education is vital, and public education is vital to renewing and defending democracy. And this is so in many respects, but let me just mention two. First, I think civic education is eroded in the United States. We are not teaching and cultivating the practice of democracy, tolerance, reasoned debate, as we once did in our public schools. And I think it is profoundly important that we not only emphasize science and math and reading skills, basic skills, civic skills are no less important. And we need to really renew our commitment and our curricular strategies, K through 12, for promoting that. And secondly, yes, Michael, as I think you know, we've had research here at Stanford in the School of Education, and other research is showing that young people, including students at Stanford, are not very adept at distinguishing between fake and real information. And so we need specific efforts in the schools to train people in how to recognize what is false rumor and what is real news, and how to use their reasoning and searching skills on the internet to evaluate what they're hearing before they come to conclusions.
And I thank Jorge for his call, and go to Mountain View and welcome Ann. Ann, join us.
Oh, hi. I was just making an email to send it instead, but thank you for taking my call. And
sure.
I wanted to say that I appreciate your guest's intelligence and his really independent commentary, which is really needed now, even if I don't always agree with his perspective. And I just wanted to point out that democracy isn't fragile if there's robust checks and balances, and that was the brilliant innovation of the American founders. But unfortunately, and I say this very sadly, the Republican Party, starting in the mid-'80s, became attached to the quest for a permanent majority, and it continues. And that is, at its heart, a quest to undermine our government and democratic checks and balances. And that led, in turn, to cognitive dissonance, self-deception, and even very unconservative behavior being defined as conservative and then rigidly adhered to. I mean, General Eisenhower wouldn't even recognize the party today.
And General Eisenhower warned us about the military-industrial complex in his last final speech. And thank you for that call. Let me go to Larry Diamond on this. They have established a majority, although before this last election we were hearing about the death knell of the Republican Party, and now people are talking about the Democratic Party as falling into for whom the bell tolls. What's your perspective on that?
Well, I'd like to make two points, and I thank Anne for the excellent question and the kind words. First, yes, the Republican Party has moved, I think, considerably to the right ideologically, but the Democrats have also moved to the left. I'm not sure it's been purely symmetrical, but I think it will be becoming more so, and I think Bernie Sanders' great success in the 2016 primaries is a harbinger of what's to come. So we do have a problem of increasing ideological sorting among the parties into purely opposing camps with very little overlap, and that's contributing to polarization. On the permanent majority question, Michael, you know, each party, you know, has this its goal to stay in power as long as possible with as large a majority as possible. And frankly, each party has used the opportunity when it has presented itself at the state level to cynically gerrymander legislative districts for pure partisan advantage. I think one of the important imperatives now in renewing our democracy and reducing cynicism about it is to take legislative redistricting, as we did in California, out of the hands of politicians and give it to independent experts, the courts, or neutral redistricting masters to redraw the boundaries. And there are other things we can do as well to ensure that political power is not abused for partisan advantage.
Let me thank Ad for the call and remind you we're talking to Larry Diamond, senior fellow with the Hoover Institution, and let me bring another caller on. Dan, welcome. You're on the air.
Yes, good day.
Hi.
Thank you for taking my call. I disagree with Mr. Diamond, sorry. The Republicans blocked not just Mr. Garland, but also, I don't know, 200 federal judiciary people for the obvious reason that we see with the judiciary challenge to the Trump's executive order. So the name of the game at this point, unfortunately, is block everything. I don't see why we need to deal with, as a Democrat, they play a certain way and then we're supposed to play a different way. It doesn't seem a smart way to hold on to power.
Okay. Thank you for the call. Larry Diamond.
Well, I certainly join Dan in, frankly, disgust with what the Senate Republicans did to block Merrick Garland's nomination. It was almost a year before the end of Obama's term. I think it was a violation of the spirit of the Constitution. I don't defend the other blocking behavior as well. It's deeply troubling. I would just say a couple things. Number one, I don't think it's going to be politically smart for the Democrats to do this. It may, you know, excite and ramp up their base, but it's also going to offend a lot of swing voters. Keep in mind, you know, Obama did get reelected in 2012, partly because of voter disgust with this style of obstruction on the part of the Republicans. And I think that pure obstruction, if they're trying to beat Donald Trump in 2012, will play into the hands of the president and his party and not into the hands of the Democrats. Second thing, Michael, is can we have a little bit of concern for the future of the country and the governability of our democracy beyond pure partisan advantage? Does it always have to be purely a calculus of what's good for my party or what I think, you know, as an individual might be good for my party at this particular moment?
A comment that I think is important to address here, and listeners may want to weigh in on this too, because I think it's a very important question from a listener named Gilberto. But let's hear what Larry has to say about this. He says, Gilberto's asked, could you please comment on how to get the general public better informed and engaged in our democracy? Now, we spoke about public education, but any other ways that really need to be stressed here, Larry Diamond?
Well, we have to get the new media companies, which are the social media companies, the big internet companies like Twitter, Google, and Facebook, I think, to do a better job. Facebook has started down this road now of identifying and flagging false information, fake news, and really scurrilous rumor mongering. That's the first thing. They don't want to be in the role of filtering and mediation, and I'm not saying they should be censoring, but I do think they have some responsibilities in this regard. And then a lot of people are thinking about this, Michael. We're in a new era now in terms of flows of information and education, and I think we need a lot of innovation in terms of websites, phone applications, and so on, that will find new ways to spread news and information to people and break through the echo chambers that are isolating people from one another. One of the thoughts I had, this may sound fanciful or ridiculous, but I would like to see a national effort digitally to pair a person on the left with a person on the right, maybe kind of randomly chosen, and just get them into conversation with one another once in a while, electronically. All the evidence shows that when you interact with people from the other side who disagree with you ideologically, it leads to more flexibility, more moderation, and maybe a little more, you know, reasoning power as well. And I think we are so socially isolated from one another now more than ever, residentially, socially. There's overwhelming evidence that people are increasingly, you know, marrying only people who agree with them politically.
Or only having that, Facebook friends who politically agree with them.
Yeah, it's not healthy. And so we need to find ways to generate, again, returning to my late mentor, Seymour Martin Lipset, a famous former San Francisco resident, cross-cutting cleavages where you're pulled in multiple directions because you have some people in your – used to be a bowling league and a church group. Now, you know, maybe it's a soccer club or a book club or something. Some people who actually don't agree with you politically and force you to think and reflect a little bit more.
And speak in a civil way, as we try to encourage people to do on this radio program.
Yes.
Let me bring
yes.
another caller in. David, that's you. Thanks for waiting.
Hi. Hey, you know, I noticed your discussion about the 16% of people wanting more of a one-person leadership and all that, you know, interesting discussion that you had there. And I'm surprised that not many people are really discussing the whole fact of him, this era of a Donald Trump administration, wanting to eliminate the whole Johnson Amendment and bring more of a church and state together. I mean, I see sound bites of it all over the place in all sorts of news. And I'm really surprised nobody's really talking about this and bringing this up as a more of a concern, because it seems to be bringing us back to this, you know, fascist one world state or one, you know, a church and a state, you know, governed by one person.
Well, David, you just brought it up here. Let me go to Larry Diamond on this concern about erosion of democracy through lack of separation of church and state. Larry Diamond?
Well, the Johnson Amendment was enacted and pushed by Lyndon Johnson for reasons that, you know, it appears were not terribly principled at the time. But I think the effect was a good one, to keep religion out of politics. We're not talking about religion in the state now exactly, but rather not having churches as, you know, charitable nonprofit organizations engaged in politics. I think that's a healthy line in our democracy to preserve, and so I would be opposed to removing it.
And I thank the caller. And Larry, could you say something about all this concern over deep state?
Well, yeah, on the one hand, you know, I'm very conflicted because on the one hand, you don't want the intelligence community and the professional national security apparatus to be disloyal to the president, to violate the chain of command and so on. On the other hand, what do they do when you have professionals who've devoted their careers to, first of all, fighting Russian and before that Soviet efforts to penetrate and subvert our politics and our society and our closest secrets. And second of all, you know, trying to defend our democracy abroad and so on. What do you do when the president of the United States is promoting demonstrably false information? So I think they've been put in a difficult situation. And I think that the imperative here to get back to normal and proper conduct, Michael, is for the House and Senate intelligence committees to really thoroughly investigate everything that has been alleged. I would prefer to have on top of that an independent counsel conduct an investigation. But it's got to be thorough, and then they've got to really share as much as they can with the American public, because until we investigate what has been alleged, including the variety of possible relationships between people associated with the Trump campaign and the Russian state, this anxiety and concern is going to continue.
We're talking to Larry Diamond of the Hoover Institution and the Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. And here's Tom from Oakland. Join us.
Hi, good morning. While I certainly share the professor's concern for increasing autocracy across the world, represented for the most part by Putin's Russia and increasingly U.S.'s under Trump administration, I wanted to challenge the incomplete narrative that the chief export of the U.S. is democracy. Have we forgotten the Shah of Iran, our five-century-long support of the fundamentalist regime of Saudi Arabia, military aid to Israel and Egypt, Angola, and suppression of independence movements all across Africa and Asia, and the Nicaraguan Contra movement in South America, Central America. So I would like to challenge that contention. And we don't even have to go back to history that far back. I share his concern for the America's increasing support for a military dictatorship.
Tom, let me jump in here because we're running short on time. I'd like to hear, it's a good question you're raising. I'd like to hear Larry Diamond's response to it. The United States has supported a lot of autocratic
absolutely.
Regimes.
I mean, you know, I think that most of what Tom has said in terms of U.S. relationships with those specific countries is correct. And I would only say that that is also an incomplete narrative. I have criticized these U.S. policies in the past and strongly denounced American support for Pinochet, the Shah, Mobutu, Mubarak, now al-Sisi, who is the most authoritarian ruler of Egypt in decades and I think is really destroying the country.
More than Mubarak.
No question, Michael. General Sisi is far more authoritarian than Mubarak ever was. That's the irony of the situation now in Egypt, the tragic one. But the last several decades, so a lot of that, those are very old examples. And in the last, I'd say, three decades in particular, we've really begun to develop a new generation of tools and programs to support democratic groups, democratic movements, independent mass media, independent trade unions, think tanks, business associations around the world to enable them on their own, not in the U.S. image, but in their own context, to build and deepen democratic institutions. I think that has made the world a better place, a more rights-respecting place, a place that's been friendlier to the United States and more you know, to our liking in terms of sharing a rule of law and democratic values. And I think it would be a tragic squandering of our own national interest if we abandon that.
Larry, let me get some quick responses to a couple things from you because we are running short on time. Patty writes, I'm very troubled that Mr. Diamond is relentlessly blaming Democrats for delaying the approval of the Deputy Attorney General. He surely must be aware that Senator Chuck Grassley, a Republican, is the one specifically holding up the nomination.
Yeah, that may be. But a lot of Democrats have also, you know, been warning that they won't approve him unless he commits to an independent counsel in advance. And I don't think it's smart politically to do that. And I don't think you can ask a future deputy attorney general to make that commitment in advance.
Seconds left here, but right off the newswire, the leaders of the Senate Intelligence Committee just announced that they see no indication that Trump Tower was the subject of government surveillance. Thoughts from you, Larry.
And that is, to me, no surprise. And now I think the president has an obligation to withdraw his allegation.
I'm sorry. I'm sighing because I keep thinking about all the allegations about the former president of the United States not having been born in this country. Did he ever actually withdraw those? I'm not sure he did. Anyway.
He did. Well, he did, and it took him a long time.
Yeah. I mean, ultimately he did. That's true. Larry Diamond, good to have you with us. Appreciate your being with us, and carry on. Thank you. Larry Diamond, again, is Senior Fellow Hoover Institution and Freeman Spogli Institute for International Studies at Stanford. We're here with you Monday through Friday, 9 to 11, an hour repeat at 10 to 11 in the evening, and Forum is produced by Irene Noguchi, Tina Larberg, Susan Britton, and Judy Campbell. Engineer is Danny Bringer, engagement producer Amanda Stupai, and we get online support from Amanda Font. You can always let us know what you think about what you hear on Forum or would like to hear by emailing us, forum@kqed.org. Senior editor is Dan Zoll. Our executive producer is Holly Kernan. I thank you for listening, and for all of us here at KQED Public Radio, I'm Michael Krasny.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio and the Germanicos Foundation and the Generosity Foundation.